Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Legends, the greatest social casino experience has arrived at Legends.com. With thousands of the best free-to-play casino-style games, chances to earn millions of bonus coins and win real money. Legends is revolutionizing the Vegas experience wherever you are. If you love winning, then you'll love playing at Legends.com. Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Play responsibly. Visit Legends.com for more information. Legends with a Z.com is legendary fun.
Looking for a new job? Just go to Indeed and Bob's your uncle. Except we don't really care who your uncle is. Sorry, Uncle Bob. Instead of who you know, we want you to show off what you know. Indeed lets you put your skills and experience front and centre so you can match with jobs that fit your talents, not your family tree. Download the Indeed app and start making the world work better for you. Today.
The original motion to dismiss was filed in front of Judge Cannone, basically saying, we've heard from jurors, and they're saying that all 12 jurors found Karen Reed not guilty on counts 1 and 3. And because of that, you can't retry her because it'll be a double jeopardy claim. As I told you before, I don't usually comment on whether I think she's guilty or innocent. You know, I was a judge for 20 years. I like to leave that to the jury, and I think that's the way it really should be.
True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. And for those of you who have never been on the channel, I just really want to thank you for being here. Thank you for giving it a look. We are a channel that really welcomes your takes. We cuss and discuss true crime, and we really keep it to the facts. This definitely isn't a drama channel, but we're going to have a lot of facts presented, and we're going to have amazing guests to come help us sort of look at the different crime and try to figure out where we're at on different issues, legal issues, psychological issues of some of the people we look at, and so on. So thank you all so much for being here. Today, we are going to be discussing the case of John O'Keefe. For those of you who don't know about the O'Keefe case, John O'Keefe was a Boston police officer who was dating a woman named Karen Reed. They dated for about 2 years. And essentially what happened was they went out for a night of partying and drinking. Actually, he was out before Karen Reed. He was celebrating his daughter's acceptance into a school. And what's interesting about this is, and I shouldn't say interesting as much as truly tragic, is that John O'Keefe adopted his niece and nephew after their parents, his sister and brother-in-law, really met with just tragic life-ending situations in separate issues. And so he went ahead, moved forward, adopted the children. And what's really neat is he actually took kind of a desk job, if you will, with the police department so that he could have a more controlled schedule and time. He worked in the area of sex offenders. And it was really such an unselfish and wonderful thing. And that is the reputation John O'Keefe had. He had this reputation, certainly in the community. He did so many charitable things. And he was just kind of the most beloved guy, a bachelor. And but had been dating Karen Reed. And on this particular night, they had gone to a couple of bars and had consumed a lot to drink. And one of the individuals there that they were drinking with, his name was Brian Albert. He was a fellow Boston police officer. And he said, listen, you know, my son's having a small gathering, and do you want to come over and everybody. He invited basically everybody that was around them and at the table. So, you know, this was a super small gathering that it ended up being about 11 people or so. And they head out from the bar to Brian Albert's house. And again, Brian Albert's son in his early 20s was celebrating a birthday, but he wasn't a partier. He had a couple of friends there. And then Brian Albert invited his friends, the McCabes. Of course, his wife was there. And Brian Higgins, who was an ATF agent, John O'Keefe, and his girlfriend, Karen Reed. So Karen Reed was driving her Lexus SUV. And they, meaning John O'Keefe and Karen Reed, were at the end of a relationship, according to multiple witnesses that testified at the trial. They had had a horrible fight and argument that ended up so ugly in Aruba just preceding this. They were not getting along, according to the children who testified at the trial, both children. And he had, in fact, asked her to please leave the home, and she did not leave. So things weren't going well in their relationship. Nevertheless, they made the decision to go over to Brian Albert's house for this after party. There's a lot of conflicting information as to why Karen Reed herself didn't want to go to the after party. I've seen multiple things that she said, whether she had a headache, she wasn't feeling well, she was angry. Whatever the situation was, she dropped John O'Keefe off. That is, all of this is sort of uncontested. But what is not uncontested is what happened after John O'Keefe, exited Karen Reed's vehicle. According to the prosecution, she was angry. She threw it in reverse, backed into John O'Keefe. His arm was hit by the taillight, shattered the taillight, sent John O'Keefe back where he struck his head on the cement curb area. This was a huge blizzard that was actually ensuing and got ever worse through the night, and he laid there unconscious, and she left him to die in the snow. Later, the Reed side of the equation, the defense, initially said, listen, this wasn't on purpose. This was a huge accident. She loved him. That was per her attorney, Yannetti. But that quickly changed when it came to social media and actually working with individuals to blame individuals in the house. So basically everyone in the house has been blamed because supposedly they all conspired to cover up what occurred at 34 Fairview Lane, which was the home of Brian Albert. Now, I say that, but in particular, they blamed an ATF agent, Brian Albert, who again had over 30 years as a Boston police officer, and a dog and a 17-year-old in particular for brutally beating John O'Keefe, purportedly, and then brilliantly throwing him on the front lawn. Now, this is one of these cases that has been adjudicated, if you will, at least I shouldn't say adjudicated because there's been no true judgment made because the jury hung. So back in July, there was a trial in the summer. In July, it went to the jury for a decision. And ultimately, there was no decision rendered. Basically, it was a hung jury. And in fact, a very well-written note was written from the jury foreman to the judge in this case, Judge Cannone, saying, listen, we're deadlocked. There's no way we can come to a verdict. She sent them back, giving them a very particular law, basically saying, go back and you got to do your best. Listen, you know, we need you to find a verdict if there's any way. So what happened, unfortunately, was they came back again and said, again, we are hopelessly deadlocked. And so Judge Cannone said we have a hung jury and dismissed the jurors. And that was the end of it at that point. But afterwards, several jurors came forward to both sides, to the prosecution side and to the defense side, saying, listen, we actually made some decisions. We decided that of the three counts, and the three counts included second degree murder, they included a manslaughter charge, and they included leaving the scene of an accident that resulted in death. And essentially, some jurors put forth in various ways, not in an affidavit, they weren't on the stand, it was nothing like that. It was via emails and other communications sent out. Some even went to the airways and basically said, listen, we had made a decision about counts one and count three. So the murder and the leaving of the scene that resulted in a death, and essentially said, we decided on this. And but we didn't know how to tell Judge Cannone. They seemed very confused. Remember in this trial that was very interesting. I've never seen anything like this happen exactly like this. Judge Cannone had always issued these same verdict slips. A verdict slip is basically a piece of paper, and it lists out the different charges. And on that paper, you can pick not guilty. You can pick guilty. You could. It's very, quite honestly, simple to fill out. But the defense, specifically Jackson, took huge issue with this particular jury form, the verdict form. And a big issue was raised in court. We got to watch it all play out. They presented their sides, and ultimately, Judge Cannone said she'd think about it then later, and she didn't change it. And then Jackson noticed she didn't change it, came forward again. Long story short, that form ended up being changed, which I just found so ironic for all of us who followed this trial. Here, you know, I think Jackson, the prosecutor, the judge wanted to make sure that there was no confusion. I can't wait to see what will happen in the second trial. This is headed to a second trial. It was supposed to happen at the end of January, but now they're asking for, of all dates, a postponement to April 1st, which I find interesting because that's April Fool's Day. Just kind of another irony in this case. So that hasn't been ruled on yet by Judge Cannone. She has been extremely frugal in terms of allowing postponements and things. She wants to get this off her plate. This case has been an absolute catastrophe from the standpoint of everything that has transpired. It's been very difficult. I mean, Judge Cannone has suffered so much scrutiny. The jurors wrote a letter. They're in fear for their lives. And actually, she ruled that from now until eternity, they're who they are won't be released, but social media sleuths and have already really know who the jurors were. It's just a nightmare of a case. She wants it off the plate. That's what I believe, and that's why she's been moving this along. So I don't know if she will grant this extension, but I can tell you this. Because there is a new prosecutor on the case, and I should have brought that up, there's a brand new prosecutor on the case, and this guy is a bulldog. He represented Whitey Bulger. No, he didn't win, but he is a bulldog, and he's considered an extremely aggressive and accomplished prosecutor. So interestingly, he has taken over the case as the lead, but Adam Lally, who knows this case inside and out, who I always believed needed help. He was everything. He was doing all the arguments. I mean, he had some help with some of the written responses and things, but in that courtroom, it was Adam Lally and Adam Lally on his own. He again has faced so much scrutiny, and unfortunately, I never really understood the severe scrutiny. The guy, by all accounts, is a great guy. He was little vanilla. Nevertheless, the bottom line is, what is at issue now is, did this jury reach a verdict on the murder and on the leaving a scene of an accident that resulted in death on counts one and count three? They all agree that count two was deadlocked. I've seen various numbers. 9-3 is the one I've seen the most, but I've also seen 10-2 in favor of guilty for Karen Reed. But nevertheless, they agree that was hung. So this basically went back to Judge Cannone. And Judge Cannone says, listen, no, there was no verdict rendered, period, end of story, order. You know, there's going to be no double jeopardy, because that's what they're arguing. At the crux of this argument is double jeopardy, meaning they already found and gave a verdict on counts one and count three. So it would be double jeopardy to include those same charges on the second trial in the end of January or April or sometime in between, depending on what Judge Cannone says. So that's the big argument here, very simply in a nutshell. So what happened was, this case has gone all the way to the Supreme Court of Massachusetts, the highest court that exists, to make a decision on what is going to happen. Is this going to be ruled as double jeopardy? Are they going to pull the jurors? You know, we saw this in Murdaugh. Remember this, where actually an affidavit was signed and a judge ended up talking to the different jurors. In that case, she ruled that no, the verdict is going to stand no matter what might have been said or heard, after she was comfortable that the verdict was justly reached. So this is new territory, or I'm sorry, this is not new territory. This is territory that has gone all the way up to the Supreme Court in much more egregious cases than this one, where even in a jury before the court, you know, said, hey, listen, we all reached a verdict, but because the verdict form wasn't filled out and signed, so on and so forth, and that note was written, it wasn't regarded as reading a verdict. So today we have such a special guest, but I have to tell you, my good friend, Judge Carol Erskine, is not here. I don't know why. This is absolutely not like her. I'm a little concerned that maybe she didn't reach the invite to this particular StreamYard. I really don't know. I can tell you she comes early, and I always know she's going to be here. She is wonderful. I was excited to have her just to introduce her in case she pops up here, and then I'm going to go ahead and take a look and see what's going on. But she's an author. She has accomplished more in her life than most of us do in a lifetime. She's an author. She was a judge in Massachusetts. Another reason why I specifically wanted her on the program, because she was a Massachusetts judge and she's very familiar. She's read all the briefs, and she also listened to every minute of the oral arguments that occurred yesterday. So another reason why I was so excited to have her on to give her legal opinion. She, of course, is not only a judge, she is an attorney in Massachusetts, which is very important. She's a child advocate, which to me is probably the most amazing thing she's accomplished. She's a lifetime child advocate. She wrote the book recently about Harmony Montgomery. I've been featuring that on my Twitter because it's so important. It's really Harmony's story, and Harmony's story really is not ending because of the legislation they're trying to get done in light of how wronged Harmony was. I just want to say, and she's also a college professor. So anyway, I've laid out the case. I've laid out the judge's background. I would just ask, if you will, for just a second of your patience while I reach out for the judge. I'm not going to take much time because there was another topic I had hoped to talk about anyway. So maybe we'll do it in reverse order. And that is Delphi. Because, and in fact, let me just go to this. Delphi has already finished from the standpoint of Delphi has presented all the evidence that the prosecution is going to present, that the defense is going to present, and they've done their closing arguments, and literally a 5.5 year investigation, really I can say a 7 year investigation, because the investigation went on even after they arrested Richard Allen. Here we are already in jury deliberations. Now, I, for one, find that somewhat concerning. For those of you who have had a pulse on the trial, I'd like to say that we watched the trial, listened to the trial, seen the exhibits, have heard, you know, the recordings. Unfortunately, none of us have, for the most part, unless we have Barbara McDonald or one of the other individuals that have been in that trial here with us. I'm actually looking forward to having Barbara McDonald on, too. We've been trying to coordinate a time, and I'm looking forward to hearing from her. And then I also have somebody that was on scene when the children were found that I am very excited to have on and might even do a special late tonight welcoming him to the stage. He was not comfortable with talking during the trial, but now that the trial's over, he said he'd be glad to join us here on Break the Case. So, wow, that's going to be, I can't wait. I've already spoken to him for the last 2 years, interviewed him. And I think for me, when it comes to Delphi, it's always been very difficult because of the information that I had for so long and early on regarding the crime scene and so much more. That has always given me pause. But we're going to have him on. I'm looking forward to that. But in the meantime, I want to talk a little bit about Delphi. So when it comes to Delphi, I personally have reservations that it was Richard Allen at all, but I'm still on the teeter-totter. What I don't have reservations about is that they did not prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt. What I don't have reservations about is the cruel and unusual punishment that they made Richard Allen, accused of the crime, go through without being convicted. We should all be very concerned about that. Can you imagine being picked up for a crime and put in a maximum security facility with 23 hours out in a 9x12 cell? I know I've preached about this since the first moment I've heard about this. I've challenged anybody to give me the name nationwide. I've talked to FBI agents, local law enforcement, anybody that will talk to me about this issue. And not one person can cite a situation where somebody whose case is pending trial has been treated in this manner. Period. End of story. CVS clerk living in a middle-class home with a wife and a daughter, thrown in a maximum security cell and without having a trial first. Jail, absolutely. What are the big differences? First of all, jails, which is where as FBI agents were in jails all the time. We're interviewing people in jails and they are set up for individuals to meet with their attorneys, for individuals to meet with law enforcement. They are specifically set up that way. They have room after room after room. They are very accommodating in terms of it's easy to get in and out. You're kept in a cell that's typically open, so you're not caged in a place that really has absolutely no light coming in. You're not sitting in darkness. you're not in isolation in the way that you would be in a maximum security penitentiary. The biggest thing also, I don't know if you remember this, but while Richard Allen was in that prison, at least initially, guards were watching and recording his sessions with his attorneys. You all remember this? I couldn't believe it. And it was argued, yeah, but, you know, did they have sound? Was it just a video recording? Blah, 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 blah. They stopped doing it ultimately. But talk about absolutely a Sixth Amendment violation. I think a lot of people might have forgotten about all of that. But in any event, he was not treated right. And all of us, everyone, whether he is guilty or not, should be screaming from the rooftops about this. And I just want to tell you, to say that he couldn't be protected at Carroll County or any other county in Indiana is an absolute lie. It's a lie. Period. End of story. These county jails have segregation that they can keep them away. In Carroll County specifically, and I spoke with a Carroll County jailer about, it was last week, about this. They actually have video where they watch people who are in seg to make sure they don't kill themselves, to make sure that, you know, nobody tries to get to them, to make sure that nothing, you know, that they're protected. Because they're in seg for a reason, and that is they could be seen by other inmates, or, you know, particularly other inmates, as coming in there and killing them, causing them harm to make themselves famous, right? I'm the one who killed the person who killed Abby and Libby type of situation. So for this very reason, they are kept in segregation. Having said that, what happened to Richard Allen was horrible in this regard. And quite frankly, if they just would have put him in a county jail and he confessed, we would be looking at a whole different set of facts. But because he was kept in those deplorable conditions, and some will believe, I'm on the fence, that he went crazy in there. And it makes sense that he would go crazy. Almost anyone would go crazy in that type of an atmosphere. So in any event, that is the question. Are those confessions that he made, 61 of them, are they legitimate or not? Was there any nugget that they gave? You know, what always bothered me about that is, if, just in my experience, when people confess, no matter who they confess it to, they give so much detail. Oh, I was sitting there and I saw them and I just couldn't control my sexual urges. And I went over and what I did was, and there's nothing like that in here. There is not the specificity and detail that I would have expected for such a confession. So that it gives, you know, me, I think a lot of people, great pause. Also, you know, there was new information that came out from the FBI cellular phone examiner that said, listen, headphones were plugged in to the phone of Libby into the night, you know, 5 o'clock in the night for many, many hours. And of course, Richard Allen had an alibi at that point. He was at home. And I think that's very interesting. Since then, there's been a lot on social media about, listen, if a phone is wet, it will imitate that. In other words, it's hard to tell whether headphones are truly plugged in or whether this is happening because of the wetness and moisture in the phone, and it can mimic that. Listen, this is an FBI forensic analyst. I have huge confidence in their findings. Working with them for 25 years, it's amazing. That's what they do. They do it day in and day out, and they are excellent at it. I can't believe they can't distinguish water damage and what would happen as opposed to this. However, that phone, did it move from out from under Libby? There are so many questions on this front. If the jury believes headphones were plugged in, maybe they will find that there is insufficient or that there is probable cause and was insufficient facts to convict Richard Allitt. But what they have going for them, I think, of course, is he puts himself there. I will always say, though, the Monadnock Bridge in this huge area is vast. Does he put himself on Ron Logan's land? No, he doesn't put himself on Ron Logan's land. But nevertheless, he puts himself in and around that area. As Mac brought up, she said, listen, why would he park so far away? Nobody wants to park that far away. And I was thinking, well, it really depends on your purpose. If your purpose is to walk and get exercise and hang out on the bridge and, you know, walk through the woods, I'm not sure where you park is that relevant and important. But she found that fact very important, just the length of where he ended up parking. As far as the other evidence against him, to me, I just wasn't convinced at all from the witness descriptions, you know, muddy, bloody. One of the things I was looking for that I didn't see, if somebody else here saw it, please let me know. But I did not see where they describe somebody of this diminutive of stature. He's 5'4". That is a very, I'm not trying to be mean if there's any short stature people out here. That's a very, very short stature for a man. Extremely short stature. Well under 5 inches under the average size of a man. And I don't remember reading anyone say there was a little man out there. We heard clothing description. We heard bloody. We heard money. I never heard anything about a diminutive man. I mean, he was about the size of Libby, you know, that stature. If somebody else did, please, you know, let me know in chat. I'm going to quickly let my mods handle the chat really quick, and I am going to see where Miss Judge Carol is. See what I can see here. Oh, okay. This is the problem. She did not get it. I'm going to rescind it right now. I was worried about that. Okay. She is so responsible. So let me send this out really quick to her. Sorry about this. I'm going to actually send it from my other email account. So just hold on 1 second if you could be so kind.
Hallelujah. Wow. Here we are.
Hallelujah.
Wow.
How are you?
Here we are.
Hallelujah.
Wow.
Okay. We're having some sound problems here, though.
Yes, I hear that. A little bit of feedback, Judge. Huh.
I hear that. A little bit of feedback, Judge.
Yeah.
Huh.
I'm going to remove you and bring you right back.
All right.
And bring you right back.
All right.
How's that, Judge?
I
bring you right back.
I am just checking to see if I can hear you okay. Can you hear me all right?
I can hear you perfectly. Everybody in the audience, yes. Here. Audience? Mods? Let's see. I see everybody saying hi. Hello? Oh, I see. Hello, Carol. Okay. Alan says we're good.
Oh, good. Okay. I just had my son, Nick, you know, doing all the technology to get me back on. So I didn't have the original link. So I apologize for being late, but I definitely wanted to be on to talk about this. It's such an important topic. So
great. Well, I set up the whole situation. I talked about what happened, that it went before the Supreme Court. I did not talk about the positions. I was going to let that you handle that, meaning the motions, the responses, and then the oral arguments that took place. So, Judge, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, thanks. It's such a huge topic. Boy, a lot has happened in the past couple of days, right? I mean, it's been a crazy week. As I told you before, I don't usually comment on whether I think she's guilty or innocent. You know, I was a judge for 20 years. I like to leave that to the jury, and I think that's the way it really should be. The appellate issues are just extremely interesting to me. I teach constitutional law. You know, I think it's something that's always been really important to me. And this case in particular brings up like amazing constitutional issues. So the original motion to dismiss was filed in front of Judge Cannone, basically saying that the jurors found, we've heard from jurors, and they're saying that all 12 jurors found Karen Reed not guilty on counts 1 and 3. And because of that, you can't retry her because it'll be a double jeopardy claim. And so then of course the Commonwealth responded basically saying, you can't rely on that. They sent you an unequivocal note when you declared this mistrial, basically saying, you know, they had their deliberations. There were nothing further would be accomplished by the deliberations. And Judge Cannone denied that motion. Interesting in the denial of that motion by her was her statement, which was actually brought up in front of the Supreme Judicial Court, that she credited the veracity or the truthfulness of the jurors that had contacted either the defense attorney or the prosecutor. But what she's saying in terms of the denial was, despite the fact that I find it credible, I can't bring them back without invading the jury's deliberations. And that, in essence, is a no-no. So basically, there can't be a situation where you bring jurors back, but there's sort of this bright line there where you can't get into their deliberations. So the defense is arguing, no, you can bring them back and you can simply ask them, did you reach a verdict or not reach a verdict? This was basically a huge argument in all of the briefs, including the ACLU brief, basically saying, if you don't bring these jurors back, then you run the risk of a double jeopardy issue. In other words, she has a constitutional right not to be tried again in certain cases. And so that's really what the issue is. So there are a lot of concerns regarding the arguments that are made here. They are very, very serious constitutional arguments, double jeopardy, and what is called manifest necessity. In other words, a mistrial can only be declared when there's manifest necessity to declare it. In other words, I guess an easier way to put it is not, you know, there was nothing else. So the arguments in the briefs are really addressing those issues. Is there a risk of double jeopardy? Was there manifest necessity? Should she bring the jurors back? Can she bring the jurors back? And if she brings the jurors back, is there a way to provide the jury with the level of appropriate questions by limiting those questions to whether there was a verdict? So those arguments were made by on both sides, with, of course, with the prosecutor saying, look, the judge came back in. This was the third time she came, the jury came back in and said, we are absolutely deadlocked. This was after the Tui Rodriguez instruction. And it was the third time that they made very clear. So the judge was well within her rights to declare a mistrial. End of discussion, hard stop. But the argument of Reed is that the law requires the judge to give the defense and the prosecution the opportunity to be heard when there's a declaration of a mistrial. So what was so interesting in the arguments before the SJC has to do with many of the questions that the justices asked, because the Commonwealth said, and judges asked about this, and they really pressed on this issue, well, didn't the defense make very clear they were in agreement with a mistrial? Maybe not when the mistrial was declared, but after the first note, they seemed to be supporting giving the Tui Rodriguez instruction, even though the Commonwealth was against it, saying give them more time to deliberate. And then there was the second note where she gave the Tui Rodriguez instruction, and the defense attorneys for Reed said, yes, go ahead and give the Tui Rodriguez instruction. So the argument is, did those prior sort of agreements about the jury being deadlocked qualify as consent to the mistrial that was ultimately allowed without Judge Cannone saying anything? That was the big argument before the appeals court. And the justices really pressed them on this, saying, look at this note. I mean, could it be more clear? You know, they said, you know, we're hopelessly deadlocked. It was very eloquently written. Any further deliberations would require us to compromise on these deeply held beliefs. I mean, it was just an extremely well-written note. And so the justices were saying, look, what were the chances that anything else would happen other than the declaration of a mistrial? But Reed's attorneys are saying, really, when you come right down to it, that's not the issue. The issue is it requires consent. It requires an agreement and consent. And so then the arguments are, well, did they consent because they had already consented to the Tui Rodriguez instruction and they wanted a mistrial? And did they consent by their silence, by not saying anything when she said, I'm declaring a mistrial, end of conversation? This was also another huge argument before the court, with the prosecutor saying, look, there was maybe 30 seconds from the time that the jury walked in, from the time she read the letter and the jury came in. There was a very short period of time. These were really key arguments in the case. And it seems like the justices were concerned about the consent issue, because they said to the prosecutor, is that really, you know, does silence really qualify as consent? I mean, to declare a mistrial, you have to have consent. And the Commonwealth kind of blames the lawyers, saying, well, no one said anything. They should have said something. But it's really a requirement of the judge, which is being argued, that she had an obligation to get consent and she didn't get consent. And once she didn't get consent and declared the mistrial, there's a problem with manifest necessity, because she would have had to find that there's manifest necessity and didn't give them a chance to say anything. So those are the major arguments.
Judge, okay. Hold on here.
Lots of issues, right?
But when you talk about consent, as you well pointed out, they came forward with this note. Mm-hmm. With this note that, to me, that's the crux of it. This is what the judge had to work with. And I quite frankly have never seen a judge, and maybe it happens, where they would pull a jury about it being a mistrial. That just doesn't happen. Like I said, maybe you've seen it. I have never seen anything like that. And so isn't consent the note?
Well, I mean, they're arguing that by, you know, the it's consent of the defendant. So in other words, Karen Reed would have to say, yes, I'm in agreement with a mistrial. So what they were saying is, well, technically they said that twice before because there were two other notes. And in the first time, the defense said, give the Tui Rodriguez instruction. And the prosecutor said, no, give them more time to deliberate. And then in the second note, the defense attorney said, give the Tui Rodriguez instruction, meaning, you know, that they were maybe tacitly in agreement with it. But what the focus is on is what happened the moment Judge Cannone said, I'm declaring a mistrial, and didn't ask for consent. And they're saying that that was a crucial mistake that, in essence, is one of the reasons Reed's constitutional rights were violated. Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial was one issue raised, and the Fifth Amendment privilege, of course, that it triggers the potential for double jeopardy for someone who's being accused of murder and could spend her life in jail. So these are very weighty issues, and yet it's so weighty that it comes down to how they're viewing this note and what happened before the note. Those are some of the issues. So that was one issue. The defense argued, look, this judge had options. You know, there were three options that she had.
Uh-oh. Where's the judge? Uh-oh. All right. So I'm sure the judge will be back. She mentioned she was having some technical issues, and I think her son had helped her with that. So hopefully she'll come right back on and get her son to give her a hand here. But there's something I'm going to ask the judge, and I want to see if there's any details that you want to ask the judge. But one of the things that I'm having issue with here is, I don't know if you all watched this, but for those of you who actually watched the trial, and when they reconvened, right, we all jumped right back on to hear the questions or what the jury was saying. Do you remember in this, Yannetti and Jackson, the defense team, chomping at the bit to have it declared a mistrial? I mean, that's what I remember. Because I remember thinking, you know, no, don't do that. Because typically when you see something like this, we just saw it in the trial very recently of the woman who was accused of murdering her husband. They called it the burn pile trial. We just saw that where they came back, they did Tui Rodriguez, they went back and deliberated again. And guess what? They were able to come to an agreement. So from the prosecution standpoint, if it's my case, I want to send them back, because I think more times than not, that's what ends up happening, is they end up coming to a conclusion. And I think many times it is a positive conclusion for the prosecution. And that's why I always thought when Yannetti, particularly, I remember him, you know, all right, good, mistrial. He seemed very affirmative. So back to this consent issue, it seemed like there was consent, but I have also never seen it where the Karen Reed would give consent, but rather her attorneys. But maybe that's what the judge is saying. Let me see what we have here. See, everybody's saying, yes, they remember that. I don't know about you guys, but I was like, wow, Yannetti, you know. And quite frankly, mistrials, as you know, are a win. They're a win for the defense because their client hasn't been found guilty. So it's considered a win for the defense. Let's see. Everybody's saying yes, yes, yes. They were out the night before it was declared a mistrial celebrating. Absolutely. We saw the pictures of that, even though people on social media, you know, tried to deny that film footage wasn't real. It was real. We know because the person who took those pictures or film, I talked to a person that talked to them. I know that's hearsay, but because I heard from the person they told. And I got the information, particularly from the film, sent to me. I sent it to Banfield. I think she pulled down that episode, as far as I know, because she had put an expert on, but her expert wasn't able to receive the information I had, so I forwarded it to them. The bottom line is they were out, and they were out partying and celebrating, and I think they thought they were going to get not guilty. Let's see what we have. Karen ran to her daddy. That could be her twin, and gave him a hug with a big smile. And she, like, she was found not guilty. We all saw that. I absolutely remember that. I think truly that they, it was a huge win. It was a huge win because it was not guilty. Let's see what else. Casey. Hi, welcome to the channel. Yes, I said it early in the chat. They couldn't wait to get that exactly onto the courtyard steps. Brooke, is that when AJ molested his own client in front of everyone and was filmed on somebody's iPhone? Yeah, that's what we're basically speaking about. I'm not sure she minded, so I'm not sure we can use that exact term, molested. She seemed to be laughing and smiling from what I saw. So, but nevertheless, yes, we're on the same page there. Here's Carol back, so I don't have to keep droning on, but I love talking to y'all in chat. So I actually enjoyed that. Let me get her back on the stage.
I don't know what happened.
It's okay, Carol. I appreciate you being here.
Oh my God.
About that, now I'm going to run it by you, and many of the members in chat agreed. When you talk about now consent of the defense and their attorneys, do you remember, Judge, were you watching when Jannetty was chomping at the bit on the first go around? Declare this. He wanted that as a win, particularly I remember Jannetty, but they were almost in a celebratory mode. Talk to us about that. How can that not be construed as consent?
Well, you know, because the judges ask about that. They said, you know, how much more did you need? But the thing is, when they agreed the first time that they wanted the Tui Rodriguez and that they, you know, it sounds like they were hoping for a mistrial. But what they're saying is, and what the defense is arguing is, there's only one time that counts. The only time that counts is when the judge says, I'm declaring a mistrial. And so what their argument is that at the moment Judge Cannone said, I'm declaring a mistrial, she had an obligation to get consent. And interestingly, when the Commonwealth was arguing, they asked the prosecutor, they said, don't you think that the judge should have gotten consent from the defendant? And he said, well, it would have been the better practice, but I don't think it was required. And he was saying that he didn't think it was required based on the fact that there had been previous notes and it seemed pretty clear. And some of the judges even said, don't you think it seemed pretty clear, you know, after the second note that, you know, that they weren't going to come to an agreement and that there was going to be a mistrial at one time. They said something like any lawyer worth his salt, you know, would have, you know, known or something like that. I can't remember the exact words, but the Commonwealth's argument is, on balance, you know, the moment she declares a mistrial is when you have to make a determination about whether there was manifest necessity. In other words, because it has to be manifest necessity, has to be manifestly necessary, that it has to be a mistrial. And so the moment she declared a mistrial was the time that she needed to get consent. And so what the defendant is arguing is, look, on balance, you know, are you going to say, well, it would have been the better practice, but you didn't have to do it, as opposed to there's case law and law supporting the fact that she had to get consent and didn't get consent. And if you say silence is consent, then basically what you're saying is that's enough to meet, or that's enough so as not to violate her constitutional rights to a fair trial, to, you know, be free of double jeopardy. So, you know, when you're looking, you know, the courts are looking at a balance. And so they have to balance this whole notion of, was there consent or was there not consent? And should we say, we think from the previous two notes that it was pretty clear that there was going to be a mistrial. And we also think that because they agreed that they wanted the Tui Rodriguez, that it wasn't necessary on the third time. I mean, I think there's case law that supports the defense arguments, but it was hard to know just how the court was going to decide. And that wasn't the only issue. I mean, the Commonwealth is saying, or the defense is saying, look, she had other options that she did not follow through with. And one of those options was to poll the jury under the rule in Massachusetts, the verdict rule, which is Rule 27B, which basically talks about polling a verdict or polling the jury on a verdict. But it's discretionary for a judge. In the federal rules, it's not discretionary. It has to be a poll. But in Massachusetts, it's not. And so there's an argument there saying, you know, Massachusetts, you know, should follow the federal judiciary and she should have polled the jurors, especially where there were multiple counts. And what they relied on in that argument was saying, when you read that rule, then you read the reporter's notes. In other words, the notes are describing what should happen as a result of that new rule. And they're relying on the reporter's notes, saying in the reporter's notes talks about making it a requirement that it happened when there are multiple charges so that it's clear what happens in multiple charges. I mean, do I think, and that's one of the options, you know, that they outlined. And that's probably the most argued one. I've said from the beginning of this, and I've posted it multiple times, that after this case, there'll be a rules change in Massachusetts making it a requirement for judges to poll jurors, especially when there are multiple charges. But will that be the case here? I just don't know. So you have this, you know, I think the biggest argument is for the defense, because I think some of their other arguments may have fallen short, is that, you know, is the manifest necessity argument. I mean, really what it boils down to is the defense's position is this judge made mistakes. I mean, she made mistakes. She just came out and declared. She didn't say to the lawyers, you know, do you want to say something? And one of the arguments that the defense lawyers made is, look, the two previous times, what did she do? She did what she was required to do. She said, defense, what do you want to say? Prosecutors, what do you want to say? She did that the first time. On the second time, she asked about Tui Rodriguez. Do you want to say it? Do you want to agree? Do you want me to do this? And then the third time she comes out and says, oh, the trial is over. I'm declaring a mistrial, and didn't ask anyone. So that's the crux of the argument. Whether they challenged the defense lawyers a lot on that, but the things that you just brought up, which is, you know, didn't those first two times count? But that's really where it is.
So let me ask two questions of you. One, where's the case law here? There's no way that this is the first time this has ever happened in Massachusetts, that a trial was declared a mistrial and the judge kind of said it's a mistrial. So where's the case law on that point? That's my first question. And then I'll go to my next one after you answer.
Well, they argued that they did argue a case. I don't have it right in front of me, but they did argue that there was a case regarding consent and that the court can't drift away from that, that there's a case in Massachusetts that is clear about consent. That's why the Commonwealth, when they argued, said, well, there was consent. You know, it's a sort of constructive consent. It was by silence and it was by the previous, because they know that there's a rule that says that. And, you know, the justices may say, look, you know, we're going to find that there was consent. You know, they couldn't have been more clear on those first two times around. So it really wasn't necessary for the judge to get consent. The problem with that argument, as I see it, is the third time was the time she declared the mistrial. And that was probably the best time. But the justices were pretty, you know, they had some skepticism about that. and really pushed back on it. So I think that's, you know, really the answer to that.
I guess it's, you know, you're at the dinner table at a restaurant and the waiter keeps asking you, as they always do, do you want dessert? And you say, no. Want dessert? No, I do not want dessert. I'm absolutely full. And the next time they ask, you don't say anything. Mm-hmm. And it's presumed by the waiter you don't want dessert. But then you could change your mind. Well, okay, you talked me into the creme brulee.
Right.
I suppose that, just in a complete layman's term, is what they're muddling over as judges, is could they have possibly withdrawn the consent?
Right.
I think you're right, though, just from what you've said here, that that's going to be a bit short, although I could see it being a new law.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think it's not clear. I think that as they argued that there was a case, but in using the analogy that you used, nothing's at stake if you don't say anything the next time. I mean, the waiter just goes away. I mean, you don't go to jail if there's a mistake, you know, or you don't go back to a trial where you could go to jail. There are no constitutional rights at stake. And that's what makes this such a high stakes thing. Yeah, I have said all along, I mean, it's clear that the justices were struggling with their brilliant justices. And, you know, they really did pummel them with lots of, you know, lots of questions about it. I think one of the interesting things, and I don't know if you saw this, but the next day or the day at the day, right, actually that same day following the arguments, people are like, oh, this was really bad for Reed and this was terrible. Did you hear all those questions they were asking her? And, you know, this seems like it's a bad prediction. I have to say, I chuckled a bit about that, you know, because I've appeared before the SJC in the appeals court. And I always go back to this one case where I was assigned as an appellate attorney to represent a mother on a case where the both children had been tested positive for cocaine, but the Department of Children and Families put the children with the parents and then said, well, you keep testing positive for cocaine, so we're going to take the children away from you. And they did, and they put them in a foster home that was a pre-adoptive home, and they wanted to have the children adopted. And so there was a termination of parental rights case. I didn't do the trial below. I only did the appeal. But in the trial below, the lawyer said to the social worker on the stand, well, is the home appropriate? Yes. Is it clean? Yes. Do the children have rooms? Yes. Are they being well fed? Yes. Is there food in the cabinets? Yes. Are they getting to daycare and preschool? Yes. Are the children clean and not dirty? No, they're clean. And then the defense lawyer asked this question and he said, is it fair to say, because it was cross-examination, so he could lead. And so he said, is it fair to say that other than their sort of recreational or the use of cocaine, that they're as good a parent as you or I? And the social worker said, yes. So I basically took that whole cross-examination and I pasted it into my brief and made this argument that, you know, because what they terminated the rights of the parents, and the judge made a finding saying, even though things are okay now, in the future, it, obviously the use of cocaine is going to impact these children, will be in a dangerous situation, so I'm going to terminate rights. So I wrote the brief basically saying, a judge, it's current fitness, that's the standard. A judge can't just decide that in the future this is going to happen when the testimony is that, you know, they're doing fine and the children are fine and they're healthy. And the other argument that I had was, you know, there are times when children can live at home, even when parents are involved with substances. You know, maybe they, you know, they're getting treatment, maybe they're working on it or whatever, but, you know, not every substance use case requires us to terminate parental rights and sever the parental relationship. So not every case gets arguments before the appeals court, but this one did. And I knew that they were probably not too happy with me making that argument. And that showed during the arguments. I mean, during the arguments, clearly one of the justices was really angry, saying, you know, don't you admit that, you know, that it was abuse of the child because during the pregnancy, the mother was abusing the child because she was using cocaine. Well, there was no indication of how many times she had tested positive for cocaine only at birth. And I said to them, and they said, you know, don't you think that these that this reproductive decision that the mother made should be the main factor. And I said to them, no, you decided that. And you decided that when you issued previous decisions saying we can't make decisions about, you know, what about a parent on their reproductive choices. And then they said, well, the father had a criminal record. Well, he had a minor criminal record. And to which I said, well, lots of people have criminal records. Not every criminal record is a termination of parental rights. Well, I mean, they like pummeled me, just like the SJC sort of went after the defense today. And I walked out of there saying, there's no way I'm going to prevail on that case. And then 3 months later, I got a call from, I don't know, WBUR or one of the public radio stations that said, do you want to comment on adoption of Catherine? And I had no idea what that was because they had given it a different name. And I had prevailed in that case and they had vacated the termination of parental rights and sent the case back for additional evidence on something. And, you know, that was a lesson to me. I thought that sometimes when the justices are really, you know, pummeling you and coming after you, that they're doing it because they want to know if you can hold a cogent position to support your position, even if they don't like it, and even if I didn't like the position that I had. And that, I say, is why I had a different view of what happened in the SJC. It's Reed's petition, and she's making these arguments, and these justices are saying, read this note. They read part of the note, to the lawyers, saying, look at this note. Look at how well it was written and how clear it was that they were deadlocked. That's what they were pushing and pushing back on them. And that's what they are obligated to do. And I think that the SJC justices do that because they want to hear from the person arguing that this is my response to that. And it's a cogent, appropriate response. And please listen to us, as they said, because at one point they said, this is a person, in their opening remarks, they said, this is a person who could be facing life in prison, but who may have been vindicated or found not guilty by a jury. So that's a long way of saying, I don't take anything from the fact that they were really tough on the defense attorney, because there's a lot at stake.
Well, I agree with you watching the social media, and I believe strictly based on other opinions that have been rendered clear up to the Supreme Court level that this is not going to go forward. However, I have to say that you're giving me pause because, and I always say this, even though case law exists, case law can be overturned. I mean, Roe v. Wade, the big example. But just because there's a lot of precedent doesn't mean you can't make a new precedent. Okay, let's play a little bit of what if. If the justices say that there was no consent, and are you saying that basically they could toss out?
No.
I don't think so either. So what happens if they say there was an issue?
That's not what anybody's even asking for, actually.
Right.
What they're asking for is to bring the jury back. And that's that. And they made that clear. Although, is it feasible that they say, hey, look, we find there was no manifest necessity for the judge to declare this mistrial. And therefore, because she declared a mistrial, the rights of this person could be violated. It was a violation of double jeopardy. So could they throw those two charges out? I think technically they could, but that's, to me, the crux of the arguments were you have to bring the jury back. But they did make that argument. They said, you know, there's no manifest necessity for this. I mean, she declared a mistrial. But I think when they were arguing about the manifest necessity issue in the declaration of the mistrial, which definitely goes to the double jeopardy argument, I think what they were mostly arguing is she didn't have the opportunity to consent, so there was no manifest necessity. So that brings up the double jeopardy. So I don't know. They could say her, you know, that double jeopardy. They did argue that. They're arguing, look, this is a double jeopardy. So yes, they could do that. But I don't think that's what they spent so much of the time on. They seem to spend so much time on the issue of consent and not getting consent. Whether or not that failure by the judge, I think they were very much looking for a way to find consent based on the two other times that they had agreed to either Tui Rodriguez or agreed that they should move ahead with Tui Rodriguez, you know, the special instruction. Could they do it? I guess technically they could, you know, because they're saying if there's no manifest necessity, then that implicates a double jeopardy violation. And therefore, those two charges are out the door. But what I think what I think was most concerning to them was how can we say that she shouldn't bring these jurors back? I mean, that was a huge argument. Could we bring these jurors back and just ask them a simple question? Was there a verdict? And so the argument there is by the Commonwealth is you can't do it. You can't do it without crossing the line into deliberations. That's what they were saying. And then some of the SJC judges were saying to the Commonwealth, well, yes, you know, and the defense argued, you can draft these clearly defined questions. They were even saying to the SJC, you can tell us what can be asked of these jurors. But it's a difficult argument because who knows what a juror is going to say? You know, you can ask these questions and you can say, I just need a yes or no. Was there a verdict or was there not a verdict? And then you get a juror to say, well, there was a verdict, but then juror number three said such and such. And then you're into the deliberations and that's a line you can't cross. And so it becomes incredibly difficult to figure out how to bring these jurors back and to do it in a way that would allow for the jurors to say what happened without crossing the line. It's interesting to note that the justices pointed out clearly, they said, the judge made a finding that she gave credit and found them credible, found that the four phone calls or the five phone calls, that they were credible, that they were credible things that these jurors said. So they said to the Commonwealth, you don't have that argument. And then the Commonwealth said, yeah, but it's been 4 months and a lot of things have happened. People have been harassed. They've had a lot of input and all of that. And then one of the justices said, no, you lose on the timing issue, you know, because we brought cases back like years later where the juror comes and says, you know, there were racism issues here. But the Commonwealth, I thought, had a really good argument in that case. They said, when you're asking someone if there was a racist remark said or there was racism, that's different than what's being asked here. What's being asked here, and they said it very well, they said, what's being asked here is you're asking the jury or you're asking us to construct a verdict. That's what you're saying, to construct a verdict. That's different, you know, than what you're asking of the jury. You're asking the jury to construct a verdict after 4 months, even if the timing isn't an issue. That's very different than other things that they've brought jurors back. And constructing a verdict is something that, you know, is just something that crosses a line that we think would be really dangerous and not supported in the law. So there were good arguments on both sides.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is, look at everything that's happened, as you mentioned. I mean, we have jurors that have been threatened. We have that ruling that said, listen, from now until eternity, we're not going to disclose who they are, even though everybody knows who they are because of SLUs and social media.
Yeah.
And everything that's been in social media about this case that could have influenced their decisions, you know, at this point, I just can't imagine. It's like deciding a football game and then saying, okay, everybody, let's go back and replay it.
Yeah.
And the football game is the jury deliberation.
Yeah, you can't go back and rescore the football game. That's for sure. And so in that sense, it's a good analogy. And I think the Commonwealth, I think the prosecutor, the Commonwealth's appellate attorney did an excellent job of sort of deflecting off the some of the concerns that the justices have. You know, can we just go back and construct a verdict? That's a pretty concerning thing. Although they were not impressed, the justices were not impressed that time has gone by and lots of things have happened. They came right out and said, look, we've brought cases back like years later. So, you know, we don't look at that as an issue because lots of things have happened over a period of time in those other cases. So they I don't think, at least the justice that was raising that, I can't remember if it was Graziano or Kafker, but it was either one of them, said, look, you know, we brought cases back. Now, whether they will all agree with that or not is something that you'll have to wait and see. I will say this, and nobody has said this, but the circumstances here, you know, relying on the first two notes by the jurors and then sort of separating it out as the Reed's defense attorneys want to do, saying the third case is absolutely different because that was the declaration of the mistrial and that's where manifest necessity comes in. Oh, the facts, you know, it's a mess. You know, there's just so much consideration of whether or not Judge Cannone made an error that way. As the Commonwealth said, the better practice would have been to do something different. I don't know if it was for that or for polling, but I think it was on the consent. The justices seemed concerned about that. And no one has said this, but given the stakes here, I wonder if they don't prevail, whether or not the Reed defense will ask the United States Supreme Court to grant certiorari to hear the case and make a decision about manifest necessity. There have been some decisions, nothing covers this case because it's, you know, the facts are just so strange and so bizarre and what happens is so factually dependent on it. But I have wondered whether or not, if there is a decision against Reed, whether they'll ask the United States Supreme Court for certiorari. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court decides what it will hear and what it won't hear. And they get, you know, thousands of requests a year. So whether or not they would decide that would be whether or not they think it's something they wanted to hear. But from my perspective, I think the stakes are that high. The stakes are always high when constitutional rights are at stake, especially double jeopardy kinds of issues and manifest necessity. So, but I don't want to sound, you know, I'm hoping that I'm not sounding too legal because it is a legally complicated thing, but I'm trying to explain it in a way where people sort of understand what the issues were that the SJC, in my view, was concerned about during the arguments. I think there were strong arguments on both sides. And so I have no idea how they're going to decide this.
So let me ask two more questions, Judge, and you've given so much of your time, but to say that a practice is better, in other words, asking for that consent the third time, right? Judge Cannone asked the first, Judge Cannone asked the second, or at least met the requirement of making sure there was consent by the attorneys. But in the third time, she took the silence and everything that had happened previously as the consent. And you said that the judges actually said, you know, the better practice or whatever would have been to, again, make sure, do you have anything to say? But there's a big difference, Judge, as I see it, between a better practice and a requirement. There's a lot of things that we could do better, whether it's in, you know, as a judge or as a prosecutor or as a law enforcement officer, I can handle evidence of a way that would be better, but that is not a requirement, such as, you know, the custody, showing the custody as an example. That's a requirement. So help me out with that, Judge. Why are they even really, do you think, visiting this when might have gone better if they went the other way.
Yeah, I guess you can look at it that way and say, why, you know, I mean, is there something better that could have happened? It was interesting because the Commonwealth said, look, this was 10 weeks. They went through 10 weeks. They went through all these witnesses. These jurors had to go through impanelment. All of this, they had to go through all of it. And that's a reason, and there were reasons. I'm just looking at my notes. There were reasons to tell counsel about the note to avoid. Were there reasons that they had to tell them about the talk about that last note regarding manifest necessity? I mean, was it necessary? These people had been through a lot in 10 weeks. There had been two previous times where they had sent a note in. They had gone through the impanelment. They had gone through all of these things. And really, do you think consent was necessary at that point based on what they said? And the interesting thing I thought about that was that Justice Georges said, don't you think that's the exact reason that they have been through all this? There have been all these witnesses called. There has been 10 weeks of testimony. There's been jury impanelment, and there have been these notes. Don't you think with all that, that is exactly a reason why the judge should have gotten consent? So you can look at it from your view, and that's how the Commonwealth looks at it. And of course, the defense looks at it the other way. And Justice Georges asked that question, whether he thinks that way, whether they're going to find that way, whether the six other justices agree with that. It was a question that he posed. Don't you think with everything that's happened in this case, weeks and weeks and weeks of testimony and all the things that have happened with this case, don't you think that's the exact reason why Judge Cannone or why the judge should have asked for consent and should have given them the opportunity? I will say the Commonwealth says, and then some of the justices agreed, look, they had an opportunity. They could have said, Judge, can we be heard? You know, when she declared, why didn't they say anything at that moment? You know, they could have said something. Why didn't they say something at that time? And I think the response to that was, first of all, that this is a judge declaring a mistrial. So you think a lawyer is going to step in? Even the prosecutor didn't say anything and say, hey, judge, you know, there's a problem here. You know, and a lawyer might not want to do that. And then, you know, I think the other thing that they had a concern about was, is it really the obligation of the defendant or the prosecutor? I mean, the burden in the case is on the prosecutor. So whose obligation was it to step in and say something? Was it the defense? Probably not. So those were the arguments. But he asked those questions. I say that Judge Georges asked those questions, Justice Georges, but whether or not they will agree with that. All of these questions that came up are what they're going to be deciding. Rule 27B, whether there was consent, whether there was manifest necessity, whether the judge should have asked for them to be heard, all of those questions they're going to have to answer. So such an interesting case, though, to me. You know, I'm such a legal nerd. Sorry about that.
No, that's what we need. We need legal nerds. And then I come on and put the analogy for all of us knuckle draggers out here that have not.
Great questions. People have great questions. You have great questions. I think those, you know, you're asking the questions that a lot of the justices and asking the questions that are there in the briefs. I will say the ACLU strongly supports bringing the jurors back. They're saying if you don't bring the jurors back, then you're leaving open the potential for a double jeopardy violation. And this is a person who has constitutional rights. As they always point out, and as everybody points out in a criminal trial, there's only one person in a criminal trial that has constitutional rights, and that's the defendant. You know, the whole issue of people say, well, there's a victim. Of course, the victim comes in at some point at the end of it, after the conviction. And it's important to always remember there's a victim here. Of course, I always remember that there, of course, is a victim here. But And these legal arguments are pressing and very complicated, but serious and important issues, which is why I say I don't know if they decide against the defendant, if they decide against reading this, I don't know whether they'll seek a higher court. It's really interesting, though. I think it's really interesting.
Well, you brought up the ACLU, and I just want to say this for people who might be wondering, is it normal for the ACLU to get involved? It is normal. I was looking at multiple other cases that are similar to issues concerning verdicts and concerning double jeopardy. And that's what they do. I mean, that's what they look out for. So I was not at all surprised.
Right.
ACLU is making a position and sending out a brief. So I just wanted to point that out to our listeners. I didn't want them to think that they're coming in to save the day. This is what they do. And it's quite routine, if you will, considering the unroutineness of this situation. Judge.
Absolutely true. Absolutely true. This involves serious constitutional rights that could result in a double jeopardy claim for someone who's facing life in prison. You are right. That's exactly the kind of case they want to file an amicus brief on.
Last question for you, Judge. I know you said that you're not sure which way it's going to tip. In other words, what the Supreme Court is going to say. But you've had a lot of time to think about this. I'm just kidding. Just a few hours.
A whole day.
Yesterday, right? So you had all day and, you know, sleeping last night. But in your short stint, if you were a judge on that court, which, by the way, I hope someday you run for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, they're appointed, so it doesn't work like that.
Okay, forget about run. I hope you're appointed someday.
That time has passed, but go ahead.
My question for you is, what would you do? I'm not saying what they would do. What would you do, A, and B, how long do you think this decision will take?
All right. Well, first of all, they have 130 days to write their decisions. And most of the time they go beyond that. So that's why there's not going to be a criminal trial in January. I've said that also all along. And the thing that would be hardest for me, I think, is that in making a decision, as they pointed out, they have to find that Judge Cannone abused her discretion. What she did when she declared the mistrial was an abuse of her discretion. She did not have discretion to declare that mistrial, which I think that she did based on the notes. So I certainly think it would be hard for them to find that she abused her discretion in declaring the mistrial. And so therefore, I think there's a loss of the manifest necessity claim. The problem for me would be the consent, that there wasn't an opportunity to consent. And that's the flip side of the manifest necessity claim. I think she, my sense is that she could declare a mistrial. I mean, she had been through three notes. She had given the Tui Rodriguez. She read this very eloquent and very, we're deeply divided. I mean, I don't know what more she needed. What is bothering me about the case, which is why I can't say how I would decide, is the issue of whether or not they can bring the jury back. I think that's a tough one because I think it would be hard not to cross the line into deliberations. The thing that nags at me is the fact that she didn't ask consent for the defense. And then is that a denial of her constitutional rights? That to me is the argument that I would have a hard time finding in favor of the Commonwealth. But obviously people may view it very differently, saying they consented by silence, they consented by their previous. That's a hard one for me because I think the law is pretty clear that there has to be consent. And I don't know that anybody argued there was anything else in the law that would allow them to accept consent any other way. So I know that's not an answer, but that's my main concern.
So if, again, you had made that decision then and find in favor of the defense, what would be your remedy?
Yeah, I don't, it's hard to say, you know, because I can't really say that, because if they say there was manifest necessity because she could have declared a mistrial, I don't know exactly what they would do. I mean, one thing I didn't say is they argued vociferously that she made a mistake by not polling the jury on the multiple charges that, as I said earlier, that even though she wasn't required to, the reporter notes say on multiple. So I don't know. And it's hard to say what the remedy is when it seems like she had every right to declare a mistrial, but made this error. What they could say is, we don't think that error is prejudicial. You know, so anytime a judge makes an error, and I think that they could find that there's an error, when she didn't get consent, they could say it's not prejudicial, even though she had to do it. We're going to say it didn't really prejudice the issue of whether there was a legitimate claim of a mistrial, because the evidence shows that it was pretty clear to these lawyers that they wanted a mistrial. They wanted the jury to be deadlocked. So it's always possible that they can find that there's an error, but the error has to be prejudicial in order for there to be a remedy. So we'll have to wait and see.
Well, Judge, thank you for your legal knowledge and expertise and lending that to all of us tonight. It's been really great. I know it's always hard for listeners to listen and get in the weeds. For me, I love it. I think most of our listeners actually really like it, because they are a sharp group. And I just want to thank you so much for spending your evening with us. I'm sorry it ended up going later. And definitely we'll ask you to join us again. I want to let everybody know she has just written a book about Harmony Montgomery. And I know all of us in this chat and in true crime, our hearts will always bleed for Harmony Montgomery, but what can be done in the future to prevent other Harmony Montgomerys? And that's the thing that Jenna Carroll is at the, you know, tip of the spear, trying to help with the decision.
Thank you for posting that too. I wanted to say that you posted one of the appearances. I've been doing a lot, and you know, I think if people read the book and see how bad the child welfare system is for children in Massachusetts, it might happen that we're able to get some change. So thank you for doing that. You've been really supportive, and we're grateful. I know Blair and Jonathan are grateful too.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Until next time.
It's always great to be with you. Thanks.
Thank you. Oh my gosh, she is so good. She is just so knowledgeable. And I knew she'd be the perfect one. She literally listened to every minute of that hearing, the oral arguments. And she has the background as an appellate attorney to be able to really decipher it down for us. I think it leads us with a lot of questions. I just can't imagine the precedent this would set. If you could dismiss a jury and then they all talk about their deliberations and say, well, basically, we agreed on this point. And I wanted to point out, too, for those of you who don't know, which I always found interesting in this, when it came to, it seemed like there was a lot of bartering that was going on. In other words, for instance, on leaving the scene of an accident that resulted in death, there was a lot of discussion about, you know, whether he was dead or the frostbite or something. There were a lot of discussions, I think, as far as what went on, to make that decision. And then also on, the murder. In other words, it seemed to be, from what I read, and I didn't state that very well, but from what I read, it was like a compromise. They said, okay, we'll get away with this one. And then they said, all right, we'll compromise and get away with this one. In other words, the two extremes. And let's just narrow it down to the middle one. So I wonder if they were even polled, if they would say, really, it wasn't that I thought she was innocent of one or three, but it was part of a compromise. So I just wanted to point that out. At least from what I read, it seemed like there was a compromise. I didn't state well, you know, the issue that they had with number three, but it just seemed like to be a compromise to get down to number two. And then that was deadlocked. But I'll definitely have Judge back on anytime, particularly as the John O'Keefe case goes to trial next year, to help us break down some of the very fine points of the legalities in that case. Thank you all for staying with us, even despite some of the technical difficulties. I just want to thank, let's see, if she ever has a book or movie, they can go after that money. Oh, guess what? Judge, any of the money from the book, I know you're talking about Ken Reed, but I just wanted to bring out the money from the Harmony Montgomery book. If you can believe this, Judge Carroll, even though she spent so much time, money, energy on that book, she's donating 100% to an adoption charity. To an adoption charity, because she believes so much in adoption. Please, please get that book about Harmony Montgomery, written by Judge Carol Erskine. It's so important because of the charitable contribution that will be made. And then also the points in the book, which is just the total breakdown of the system that led to Harmony's death. Let's see. Thank you, Sonia. I hope you all enjoyed it. I really, really appreciate, I want to say the name of her book, and forgive me that I don't have it right on the edge of my tongue. I always call it the Harmony book. It's on Amazon. And let's see, the book is, and I think it is doing actually really well. The name of the book is A Cruel Injustice. I'm going to put this right up here. I tweeted this out. It's A Cruel Injustice. And she's such an advocate, and to give all of that energy and everything she did and then donate 100%. I mean, that's just a person that's totally philanthropic and a person who is so giving. So anyway, I hope you all buy the book. It's like $19 on Amazon, I think, if I recall right. And get the book. And I personally haven't read it yet, but I'm going to, and I'm 100% support the judge in all of her efforts with getting Harmony's story out there. Let's see, anything else? Yeah, Kayla did get off easy. I want to thank you all again for your time. And until next time, may justice be served.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
L-E-D-E-N-P-C. Your night in just got legendary. Get ready to chase the rush, spin, win, and redeem instantly straight to your bank account at legendswithaz.com. With free-to-play slots, blackjack, keno, roulette, and more, experience all the thrills of Vegas without leaving your couch. Legends has it all.
Legends is a free-to-play social casino. Okay. Void where prohibited. Must be 18 plus. Play responsibly. Visit legends.com for full details.
Get in the game now and score a 50% bonus on your first purchase only at legendswithaz.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.